KALW.
It just kind of shows how a city like Richmond, even a smaller city in the Bay Area, can have some of these backdoor deals in order to get the financing they need.
The city of Richmond made a last-minute deal with Chevron over a proposed tax that was headed for the November ballot.
And now we have the debate on where we can use this $550 million.
Today, we hear how the money might be spent. Then we explore how technology is changing the way we experience wilderness.
Do you have a paper map with you?
No, I don't have any paper maps at all.
What happens if your phone breaks?
My hiking partner also has a phone.
The next episode of How Wild. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Chevron refinery is the largest employer and taxpayer in the city of Richmond. It also puts pollutants in the air that are harmful to people and the planet. Advocates fought to get a tax on the ballot this November, but the city recently accepted a settlement instead. Critics say the figure is pennies to Chevron. Others point out the costly litigation that could have dragged on for years. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid gets a local perspective from Joel Umanzor, a staff reporter for Richmond Side, who's been following the story.
A short time ago, the Richmond voters thought they were going to be voting in November on an initiative which would have had a very steep price for the Richmond refinery. Not so fast. There was a deal right before the council was going to vote to send this to the voters. What precisely is that deal?
Well, the city of Richmond agreed with Chevron to a $550 million 10-year deal that would be financed primarily by Chevron. There's a lot of stuff going on here in Richmond where the city's looking to for that extra revenue. For a long time, they've had to deal with lack of city services, lack of infrastructure here in the city due to the budget. But with this, the city's looking to kind of fill in those gaps and provide those critical services that the city residents need.
Chevron came up with $500 million, but it's only over a 10-year period. Are we in the rare situation where we have a win-win for the city of Richmond and Chevron, or is this a zero-sum game because Chevron would pay far less in this deal than they would on an annualized basis, at least in taxes?
I think that also depends on who you ask, really. If you ask the folks in City Hall who were able to bring this kind of deal to the finish line, they're looking at it as a win, you know, a win that would bring some of those critical services back to the residents. If you look at it from Chevron's perspective, it's a far less amount than was going to be expected of them had this ballot measure pass in November. And then if you ask the environmentalists here in the city of Richmond, they were hoping that Richmond residents would get a chance to be self-autonomous in the sense of choosing what outcome this was and leaving that up to the voters.
Well, the comedian George Burns once famously opined, if you can't do more, less looks pretty good. How much more money could the city of Richmond been able to get from Chevron if that resolution been put before the voters and they passed it?
Everybody involved was like kind of having that $1 billion figure up in the air. I don't think there was a solid number for that, but it was going to be substantially a lot more than the $550 million. The billions were to look into that remediation of the Chevron property in lieu of, let's say, 50 years down the line, the Chevron refinery closes in Richmond. Who would foot the bill? One thing that a lot of the environmentalists pointed to was a case out of Philadelphia. When the local oil company did leave, Philadelphia was footed with that bill. So many of the people involved in the communities, they pointed at those things as being the main crux of the issue of trying to bring that to voters so that they could decide who would foot that bill eventually. And now we have the debate on where we can use this $550 million.
And I'm wondering if there is a political cost that the mayor, the vice mayor, and the city council may pay for not going through with this resolution.
This is an election year. You know, the vice mayor is looking to be reelected as well in her district. In District 6, Claudia Jimenez is running against a pretty formidable opponent in Sean Dunning, who kind of touts himself as a compromiser, as someone who can get into the room and mediate things. And I think this was really a win for Vice Mayor Jimenez in the sense that she was one of the people on the ad hoc committee who was able to kind of push this across the finish line. But I also wonder about her base, which is there's a lot of environmental activists who support the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Vice Mayor Jimenez, she's a member of that political organization. So this November is going to be a really interesting election in terms of how do we see this particular race. And I think it also kind of is a microcosm of, you know, what the Richmond Progressive Alliance's influence on city council will be going forward, because they are involved in three critical races around town.
Well, the refinery has been the subject of violations. They've been fined for leaks and for burnoffs that the community is notified about them days after they happen, especially the flare-ups. Is there any protection in this deal?
Not in terms of specificity in terms of like the flare-ups and whatnot, but this doesn't close the door on the city of Richmond bringing other taxes to the refinery. I think this is kind of one of those battles that we've seen in the history of Richmond and the Chevron refinery, where this is just one of the many things that you have to deal with when you have an oil conglomerate operating in your city. I think that ultimately it may come back to them bringing this to the ballot again. You know, with it being only 10 years, that's a very finite amount of time for this money.
Well, that refinery has been around for 120 years. Is there a concern that perhaps Chevron is holding too much sway and has been able to fashion a settlement that's in its best interest and not necessarily in the interest of the residents of Richmond?
That's always a concern. I think, like you mentioned, this company has been here longer than the city's been around. So it's almost like you have to navigate the landscape knowing that you're going to have to do business with them at one point or another. So there is always that concern that Chevron's going to do what it can to either get its way or, you know, hold things up in the court and have the litigation process kind of suffocate attempts to get more financing from them.
Joel, what kind of music you listen to, man?
I'm a hip hop head, man. I'm as far back as Kool G Rap and Nas and those guys back in the 90s. But even to today, I still listen to a lot of the local artists here in Richmond and the East Bay as well.
I'm thinking about a country western singer, Kenny Rogers.
Yeah. Oh, Kenny.
His most famous song was The Gambler. And the lyrics go to like, you got no one to hold him, no one to fold him. Do those lyrics hold true for the city council of Richmond?
Yeah, I think so. I was impressed with the fact that they were able to get a deal done prior to that hard deadline of having the ballot measure submitted to the county. I think that was probably the most impressive aspect of this whole thing, was getting that done in the wee hours of the night before the special meeting. And even then, when that special meeting was announced, a lot of people thought this still could be something that's going to hit, you know, the ballot box, because of the fact that it was coming so close to that deadline. It just kind of shows how a city like Richmond, even a smaller city in the Bay Area, can have some of these backdoor deals in order to get the financing they need.
Without this deal, what kind of annual shortfall was the city of Richmond looking at? And how does this deal help address that?
The budget for Richmond it's a balanced budget, but there are deferred maintenance that the city has experienced over the past handful of years. Council member Cesar Nepeda, who represents the Hilltop Mall area and portions of Point Richmond as well, mentioned that some of this deferred maintenance is seen at like fire stations around Richmond that have some of the oldest fire stations in the East Bay. Some of these fire stations are constructed back in World War II times. So the city has put off a lot in terms of keeping these critical infrastructural things up and running. And I think that it's kind of been a pressure for them to be able to balance these budgets, knowing that they don't have the money to pave the roads. Do stuff like regulating parking tickets and parking enforcement is another thing that has lacked in Richmond. That is a big issue for folks, especially in the 23rd Street corridor, that they complain about people leaving their vehicles for days on end. So I think that not necessarily a shortfall, but there was an immediate need to get additional fundings for these services, for projects like the Safe Streets Initiative, which is being pushed by Vice Mayor Claudia Jimenez and other council members in areas that have had very bad traffic incidents or unsafe streets, people speeding. It takes a lot to get a stop sign in Richmond. It takes a lot to get a speed bump put in Richmond. So some of this funding is definitely going to see those projects.
That was Joel Umanzor, staff reporter for Richmond Side, speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. Find all our election coverage at klaw.org/2024elections. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. What do you pack before a hike or a camping trip? Sturdy boots for hiking, bottles to carry water, lights to see at night, and your phone for, well, what exactly? Up next, we find out how technology has changed our experiences in the wilderness in an excerpt from the fourth episode of our new podcast, How Wild. The series is reported, produced, and hosted by KALW's very own Marissa Ortega Welch. Here's Marissa.
One of my favorite parts of any trip in the wilderness is when I get up on a mountain pass and I can see the view in both directions. When I'm backpacking with my friend Holly, this is the moment that we get out the map.
I think we could totally see exactly where we came from.
We just hiked up a mountain pass on the John Muir Trail in California's Sierra Nevada.
Most importantly, we need to talk about where is Arrow Peak. I see it.
Oh my God, I can't see Arrow Peak.
Stop.
Usually we just bicker.
What is that bump right there the other side of Ruskin?
That lumpy thing?
Yeah.
Not Arrow Peak. Did you see how arrowy Arrow Peak was?
That's the back.
We use topographic maps to plan out our day, figure out where the next creek will be so we can get water, figure out how big of a climb we'll have up a mountain, where we're most likely to find a flat place to camp. But about 5 or 10 years ago, we started noticing that we were becoming a rare breed, people who still hike with maps, because everyone was using their phones. We were hiking a section of the Pacific Crest Trail in Washington, and we asked a hiker heading in the opposite direction where the next creek was. Instead of just telling us from memory, she whipped out her phone and opened an app. Technology is changing my experience of wilderness, and it's not just phones. My backpacking trips now begin by booking a permit online. Then I obsessively research the trips on the internet, read trip reports that are updated daily, watch people's vlogs, ask questions in Facebook hiking groups. The Wilderness Act says that wilderness areas are supposed to be places for primitive and unconfined recreation. But what does that even mean anymore? Do people want to unplug in wilderness? Even if I want to, can I? This is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. Episode 6, Primitive and Unconfined Recreation.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and get on the trail. So we'll unplug everything, and we'll be ready to go in like 5 minutes.
Okay, wait, Noah, can I record the sound of you unplugging things? Because that is the point of the story.
The sound of unplugging. Yes.
The guy you hear humoring me is Kevin Mann. I meet him at a rustic resort just outside Mammoth, California. This is a popular rest stop for hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail. There's showers, a restaurant, and maybe, most crucially, a power outlet.
You just have a rat's nest of wires, everybody charging their stuff.
Kevin's charging his phone, his InReach, which is a satellite communicator, and a power bank. He unplugs.
Here it comes.
And we hit the trail.
So, I love hiking.
Kevin's in his 60s and from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's retired from a career at IBM. The year before I met him, he hiked the entire Pacific Crest Trail, or PCT, from San Diego County to the Canadian border. This year, he's hiking shorter sections.
And that's our bridge.
Today, he and his hiking partner, Lori, are heading north from Mammoth toward Yosemite.
Okay, here we are at a trail crossing. So I'm going to go ahead and open up our app. And we need to go to the right.
The app on Kevin's phone has all 2,000 plus miles of the Pacific Crest Trail and waypoints for where to get water and where to camp.
So this is like Google Maps for hiking. There's your trail instead of the road. But this is a little symbol, almost like a dropped pin on a Google map.
It's exactly that. And then when I click on it, I can open up a detailed description of that spot. So for example, in 4.2 miles, the Middle Fork San Joaquin River, there's a campsite there. At a big river, where the trail meets a big river, there's almost always a campsite.
Without these apps, you just hike to where the trail meets the river and hope there was a place to camp. And if there wasn't, you'd look for somewhere else to sleep. But with these apps, you can figure out exactly how far away the next campsite is. You can even read comments about it from other hikers.
The latest one was, we would say, about a little more than 2 weeks ago, fire pit log seating, a river to fall asleep to. I mean, these are just like reviews like you would see on Yelp.
This is backpacking in the age of smartphones. You ready for the list of technology that people like Kevin are using?
Your smartphone, you could have some fancy other camera. Your GoPro, you have to have a power bank for your electronics. You have to have a charger for your power bank and your electronics for when you're in town. If you have texting that you need to do, you have to have an InReach or a satellite communicator. And a fair number of people are carrying solar chargers as well.
And on the smartphone itself, there's a built-in flashlight and compass. And then there's all these apps you can download that have not just maps, but all this irresistible information that's updated daily by hikers.
Like, how much snow is there on that pass? Is that creek or river still running? Is there a log down that you could cross on? Are you going to have to take your shoes off and wade through it? All that information is on the apps. And that's not on maps.
But, I mean, this is the things I'm curious about. As a backpacker myself, what I would do when I got to a large creek, because I don't use these apps, I would probably scout one way, scout another. So I guess that's my question is, you know, couldn't you just look around?
Well, it'll take you 15 seconds to look at the app. And tell you whether you should go upstream or downstream.
Okay, I obviously personally relish the chance to disconnect from my phone while I'm in the wilderness. But as these apps make navigating easier, it feels like I'm swimming against the current. Or what would be the right metaphor? Hiking up a scree field? And what I've been trying to figure out is, how is a smartphone different from anything else I bring with me on the trail? A headlamp to see in the dark, a knife to slice cheese or cut rope. Maybe it's because if you lose your knife, you can improvise, find a sharp rock, cut something with your teeth. If you lose your phone, you don't just lose your tool, because it's telling you where you are, which way to go, how to safely cross a creek. It kind of thinks for you. That's why we call them smartphones, right?
Do you have a paper map with you?
No, I don't have any paper maps at all. No, I don't.
What happens if your phone breaks?
My hiking partner also has a phone.
You could see phones and satellite devices as being antithetical to the Wilderness Act itself.
We had this conversation 25 years ago, 30 years ago in the Forest Service, when cell phones first came into existence.
This is Diana Pietrasanta. At the time, she was the Public Services Staff Officer for the Inyo National Forest, which the Pacific Crest Trail runs through.
And it was literally, is it okay to even have a cell phone in wilderness? That discussion is long gone. Now it's how to manage it, right?
I visit Diana at her Forest Service office. With every new technology that people bring on these trails, people like her have had to consider them in relation to the Wilderness Act. The Act says wilderness areas must have opportunities for primitive and unconfined recreation. It also spells out what's prohibited in wilderness, except for some exceptions. No motor vehicles, no landing of aircraft, no motorized equipment or other forms of mechanical transport. When the law was written, it had cars and chainsaws in mind. Lots of new technology has developed since then. Mountain bikes, e-bikes, hang gliders, drones. Some of this stuff is straightforward. You can't take a bike in wilderness because it's a form of mechanical transport. You can't land a drone in wilderness because it's a form of aircraft. But Diana can't tell you not to use earbuds to listen to a podcast while you hike.
No, that's personal choice.
Actually, if someone listens to this podcast while in the wilderness, can you please let me know? Is listening to a podcast while hiking a form of primitive recreation?
I was up on the PCT just a couple of weekends ago, and everybody's looking at their phone. When everybody's walking along with their head down and their phones in an application, which is basically telling them what they should experience, it turns out to be, to me, a pretty scripted itinerary and a pretty scripted experience.
Mm-hmm. Phones and the internet are changing how people hike. Honestly, I could do an entire season of stories just on tech and wilderness. Because of the internet, more people are finding out about lesser visited trails. They're all following the same routes. And these apps, like the one Kevin uses, are concentrating people in the same places. If an app lists a good place to camp along the Pacific Crest Trail, everyone shows up there. And people connect more with each other, either beforehand over social media or in person at these camp spots, and end up traveling together in larger groups.
So the idea of meeting and having what's the equivalent of almost like an event in the wilderness is very contrary to most folks' idea of wilderness or how it's being managed by the land management agencies.
This is all really tricky. In or out of wilderness, I think we can all relate to the feeling of the internet blowing up our secret spot, whether that's your favorite trail or a local bar. It can feel hard if you've been going to a place for a long time and now you suddenly see more people there. But we have to be careful not to gatekeep. Diana says the internet and these smartphone apps in particular are actually lowering the barriers to entry and helping more people get outdoors, which is a good thing.
I think some people do feel more secure in an unfamiliar place or unfamiliar terrain about their skill level, and it gives them some confidence maybe to go do something they wouldn't otherwise do.
But smartphones can also create false expectations.
I think that there is a propensity in modern society that you have every single piece of information, but quite a few people have an expectation that everything's just going to go perfectly if they have enough information and somebody else tells them what to do. And that's just not how nature works. In reality, it's actually a pretty good experience to try to get up something and figure out you can't do it. I think it's an experience that should not be missed.
Good morning, go ahead.
Yeah, we did a reshot. I think we found him.
Copy, I will be in the west side of the meadow. Should be suitable for a landing site.
Okay, we'll be down in a second.
Copy all.
About 60 trail miles to the north, the Mono County Search and Rescue Team is preparing to rescue an injured hiker. A California Highway Patrol helicopter flies in to assist, and a team of volunteers heads out on foot.
So everybody's good. We did a gear check. We're ready to roll.
All right. Let's do it. Rock and roll.
So if we do this, you can text us.
There's no service.
No, there's
no cell service.
Yeah. So yeah, you'll have to text the other InReach.
When there's an emergency in the wilderness, Mono County Sergeant John Pelichowski organizes this team to respond.
Last night about 10:30, I got a phone call from a lady in the Fresno area about her son being injured somewhere in the area of Peeler Lake.
Just over the northern border of Yosemite National Park.
The interesting thing about it was the way that it was reported. So he's hiking up here alone, and he somehow ended up injured. I believe it's a lower leg injury. And this particular gentleman that injured had no device, no cell phone, no InReach, no anything.
An InReach, the device that allows you to send texts using satellites. So even in places where you don't have cell service.
Some hikers came across him with an InReach device.
They were able to text their friend, who in turn got a hold of the guy's mom.
She in turn called us.
Because so many people now hike with their smartphones and these satellite devices, people can get a hold of John and tell him exactly where the injured person is.
So that kind of takes the search out of search and rescue. For us, that's awesome.
John can learn what happened and how his team should respond. Do they need to bring a stretcher to carry this person out? Do they need to come immediately, even if it's in the dark, or can they wait until morning? Phones and satellite devices connect him directly with the hiker to get all this info.
When they work phenomenally. But if you have somebody that over relies on their cell phone, then it can be very detrimental.
Sometimes people get in over their heads, or they just think they're in over their heads.
We quite frequently get the I'm tired phone call, or I didn't realize how far this was phone call.
Wow, really though? They'll call and just say I'm tired?
Yeah, they'll call and say that I'm tired, or it's getting dark, or I'm afraid of the bears. And can you come get us? Do you have an emergency? No. Then no. You can walk out the same way you walked in, you know, so it's a delicate phone call.
This isn't just about smartphones and satellite devices. Media itself is allowing new people to find out about places in wilderness. John says you may have never backpacked before, but if you see someone's posts about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, it could give you an idea.
I'll just go to REI or whatever store it is and buy this hiking gear and hike to PCT. And not understanding that the Pacific Crest Trail is several thousand miles through extremely rugged terrain on both ends.
John also thinks there's a way that smartphones have sort of changed how we even think about what constitutes an emergency.
I think people have grown accustomed to being connected to one another, and it's almost a security blanket. I mean, when you're in daily life, right, urban life, whatever you want to call it, and you always have Wi-Fi or cell signal, and everybody you know, everything you need, it's all at your fingertips. And then when you get out into the great wide world, the outdoors, the wilderness, and you look down at your phone and realize you do not have a cell connection, I think it causes a little bit of panic.
I have to say, I feel this myself as someone who has been backpacking in wilderness since before smartphones. I used to disconnect for 10 days without thinking about it. Now that feels way harder to do. I'm just used to being in touch more with my loved ones, and maybe less comfortable with the idea of help being so far away.
That was an excerpt from the fourth episode of How Wild, a series produced by KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch. It's made with support from California Humanities and distributed as a podcast by NPR. We'll be airing excerpts here on Cross Currents Tuesdays, but you can find a link to the entire episode and the whole series at klw.org/crosscurrents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.